This is Uncle Don presenting Porcupine Petting Zoo number 328. The station is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Potential assassins can find me in this studio any Tuesday at noon. Since my last broadcast, I spent 3 nights in Jasper National Park, where I had a chance to relax, observe, and think. With others, I slept at a resort where rentals run up to $300 a day. On Saturday night, every unit was filled, most having luxury cars or huge SUVs parked at their doors. It cost $50 in park fees to spend those 3 nights in town, a charge that seems to be fair considering it went to protecting the park from its visitors. We were invading an area allegedly dedicated to nature, but more obviously aimed at the care and feeding of occupants of expensive vehicles. Highway 16 through Jasper is crowded day and night with vehicles, passenger and transport, invariably exceeding posted speed limits while chancing collisions with tourists gawking at wildlife. This highway is being expanded to 4 lanes while construction of yet another pipeline runs parallel to it. The town of Jasper is crowded with window shopping tourists in restaurants, guest houses, and hotels servicing them. There appear to be far more homes in this supposed nature setting than could justify living space for those servicing the park. Yes, people should be able to see their national parks, but there should also be a limit to the size of the human footprint in such refuges. My only consolation was that Banff is worse. When the financial system went down the tubes, pundits asked, "Why didn't we see it coming? All the signs were there." This was the wrong question. The proper query should have been, why didn't we listen to the people who warned us? The signs were indeed there, and many people did read them properly, but few listened to the Cassandras. Even those involved in the bubble lived in hope that they would be able to take their gains and bail out before the collapse. No one wants to be the one to take away the punch bowl just as the party is going strong. Those with the power to cool the ardor failed to act. As a result, millions who believed their home and stock values could never go down were badly burned. While everyone is hoping for a recovery of prices in homes and securities, there's an elephant in the room that we don't want to see. Recognizing this pachyderm would require massive changes, and humans don't like change. In fact, those we elect to lead us are doing their best to blind us to the need for change. We're headed toward catastrophe. Blind Freddy could see it coming, and it's coming on many fronts. Sit still and look at them arrayed in front of us. We're ripe for pandemics, and not of the chicken shit variety like the swine flu. With ever more cities home to millions of people living in poverty, we're surrounded with veritable petri dishes of disease, new and old. Both the Russians and Americans maintain stocks of beauties like smallpox, which they refuse to destroy. And then there are all the ones developed as weapons of war, awaiting a breach of security to get loose. We've supposedly saved the capitalist financial system by shifting their mountain of bad debt from banks to governments. The debt still remains, sucking huge amounts of interest, draining governments' abilities to respond to pandemics and other disasters in the wings. The very growth of human population itself is a burden that the planet cannot sustain without consuming ever-increasing amounts of fossil fuels, agricultural lands, water, and other limited resources. Such exponential growth has been aptly termed a time bomb. Agricultural lands needed to feed this population are being degraded by chemical fertilizers and pesticides. Inexorably, fertile lands are being swallowed by developments, spreading deserts, and lowland flooding. Oceans are rising over some of the most productive lowlands and population centers, exacerbating population displacements. Those displacements, along with ones caused by wars and famines, threaten to overwhelm richer nations with refugees. And behind all of these threats lies accelerating climate change. These and other threats hang over our heads like the sword of Damocles, and we deny them indeed, if not in word. We know that lifestyles must be altered. Oh, but not ours, of course, just the other guys or other nations. Stephen Harper, the man aspiring to absolute control of our federal government, has declared that we need not cut emissions of greenhouse gases, as Canada is responsible for only 2% of the world's total. If you follow that argument, you must believe that Prince George doesn't require a police force, as we produce only 1% of Canada's crime. Canada need not protect our farmland as we import what we need from California, Florida, and overseas. Yes, until the U.S. and those other suppliers find that their own populations demand their foods first. We need not worry about water, as our rivers are everywhere. Yes, and can you name one from which you would dare to draw a drink? Should we conserve our remaining oil and gas supplies for the future? Should we be concerned that they are burned and contribute to the atmospheric carbon glut? Would it be prudent to ration supplies of oil until, and if, we could use tar sands conservatively? Oh my God, this would mean that we couldn't jump in our SUVs and drive anywhere at any time. It would be such an inconvenience. We know we're headed for the wall, but we continue to select leaders who deny the obvious. Of course, there's a good reason for that. There's no political hay to be made by telling folks what they don't want to hear. No politician out there will tell us the truth, as veracity equals political suicide. Stephen Harper's former campaign manager was frank when he explained the philosophy behind the Tory attack propaganda. Quote, "It doesn't have to be true, it just has to be plausible," he said. "And plausibility is enhanced when the audience wants to believe what you tell them. Isn't this one of the forces that drives people to religion? Against all evidence, people will flock to those who tell them their personalities are immortal and that a better reality awaits somewhere over the rainbow after death." We tend to condemn Afghans and those of other nations who don't immediately grasp their bosoms our preferred gift of democracy. Don't they see the blessing we offer? We overlook the experience of many nations in toying with electoral systems. The latest, most obvious one is one in which we try mightily to overlook, Afghanistan. In spite of all the lives, time, effort, money, and academic studies blown on preparing Afghans for democracy, the election was stolen from under our noses by one of the most corrupt men walking the earth, Hamid Karzai. It cost his supporters yeoman feats of intimidation, vote-buying, and ballot box stuffing to swing a bare majority, and we grasp the results as proof that his nation is maturing, soon to have a regime on the Canadian model. May the gods help them. Is there any wonder that many, if not most, Afghans would rather cast their fate to the hands of religious leaders than the type of corrupt, violent bastards now surfaced? And this could be postulated for a good part of the Middle East and Africa, where those elected by hook or crook have turned out to be even worse overlords than those who took power by force or through religion. Here in Canada, few want to go through the exercise of another federal election. A couple of months of inundation with lies, pleas, and propaganda aren't worth it, especially now that we know for sure that no pledges are made sincerely, but only with an eye to the votes they will garner. Behind Harper's campaign against an election are two unspoken threats. One is that an election could yield a Tory majority, and 4 years of that would see the destruction of whatever is left of value to the Canadian citizen, poorer citizens, that is. The other is that we get Ignatieff in office, only to find that a switch in leaders would bring seamless policies. Better the devil you know, especially if he hasn't yet absolute power. It's a hell of a note that Canadian politics has come to this. The summer I worked for Ford installing bumpers and misinstalling choke and throttle cables, I earned $1.91.5 per hour with no benefits. Those full-time laborers beside whom I sweated earned a similar amount, but with benefits. One of those benefits was a deferred payment to be collected upon retirement. In those heady days, it was assumed that there was an adequate fund put aside to cover this postponed wage. Only now do we know that this was not so. Ford's pension fund was the same as Canada's employment insurance fund. That is, it was aspirational, as the money was used to gamble, sometimes in Ford's own stock. In paper, it appeared until last year that Ford had the assets to back its obligations. When the stock market fell, it was exposed that much of the money had disappeared. Ford now has a shortfall between its obligations and assets to back them of some $1.8 billion. It can now cover only 62% of anticipated future payments to retirees. No, I'm not soliciting guesses as to who would be expected to make up the shortfall, as you know well. Ford is drawing the Canadian Auto Workers Union into talks leading to what the company calls pension relief. That is, the company blew the money and the employees are expected to take the hit. Much as we hear whining from the right about auto workers' gold-plated pensions, those pensions are not gifts, but deferred earnings which should have been protected by the employer. In a letter sent to all Canadian Ford employees, the company stated, "Prudent management of Ford's pension plans is important to the future success of Ford in Canada, and case conversion is more important than ever." Translated into everyday English, this means, "Heads, we win. Tails, you lose." My mother once told me a story from her school days. She was speaking in class using the verbal space filler of the time, listen. After punctuating her talk with multiple listens, her teacher stopped her in mid-sentence saying, "I am listening, Miss Hill." Until that time, Mother had been unaware of using the word. Times change, and with them go fashions in conversation fillers. I found soldiers of my time inserting actually, pronounced actually, in conversation amidst their usual variations of the F word as noun, verb, adjective, conjunction, and every other part of speech but article. In one college English class, an exasperated instructor told us emphatically to avoid the expression, in other words, the flavor of the day. "Say what you mean the first time and don't iterate," he told us. Listen carefully to an interview with one not coached in public speaking, and you can barely count the number of times the interviewee says, "you know," and "I mean," where they have no meaning whatsoever. These are fillers indicating that the speaker's mouth is working faster than the brain. Saying, "you know," should indicate that the speaker is relating something which is not new to the listener, implying that breath is being wasted. Likewise with "I mean," indicating a repetition akin to "in other words." I formulated the first of my resolutions for 2010. It's to do my best to filter out meaningless expressions from my conversation. When my mouth outpaces my mind, I will attempt to remain silent. Now, if I could just convince others to make the same resolution. Swine flu is in the news again, overshadowing recurring opinions from officials that the war in Afghanistan is being lost. Did you notice that whenever there's a disclosure of a government screw-up, there's always some other item pushed to the fore by the news media to mask it? All right, I'll follow their red herring and look at the dreaded pandemic in the offing. Suppose that this infection spreads across Canada, disrupting the economy and overwhelming a health system, already stretched by facility closings and lack of trained professionals. When the survivors resume their lives and the dead are buried, what lessons might we have learned? We know that diseases like flu incubate best amongst the poor. Inadequate nutrition, crowded or no housing, alcoholism, and other symptoms of poverty all make populations vulnerable to disease. Are we collectively wise enough to attack the expensive project of alleviating poverty in Canada? Recall that Parliament once passed a unanimous resolution that they would eliminate child poverty by the year 2000. Resolutions are easy. Action is expensive, and money was never forthcoming, so child poverty continued to increase, giving our country a black eye internationally. We found billions to bail out foreign corporations and wealthy financial institutions. Will we come up with similar amounts to bail out our own citizens? That was a rhetorical question, as no party in Canada really cares enough to put our money where their mouth is. Let me give Gordon Campbell's Liberals their due. They have a plan for the homeless. Legislation is proposed that would allow officials, presumably the Mounties, to require those without a home to accept temporary accommodation. Homeless folk would be rounded up and taken forcibly to a suitable shelter for their own good. BC Housing and Social Development Minister Rich Coleman tells us that his government, quote, felt morally compelled to act, close quote, to save homeless folk from discomfort in cold or wet weather, such as will be upon us, say, in February of next year. Certainly this humanitarian service will not be offered in all locations at all times. Alleyways and abandoned buildings in Prince George will not be scoured for worthy clients eligible for this free service. Even Vancouver's East Side will not see sweeps by social workers and cops watching for the needy. Not now, anyway. We may not see implementation of this benefit until perhaps February of 2010, and then only in Vancouver and Whistler. Surely suitable accommodation will be provided, but probably not in the metropolitan area. Perhaps New Denver would be found appropriate, a place which during World War II hosted a concentration camp. This is not a new move for Canada. We did the same to Ukrainians, Germans, and Japanese in times of war. Their populations were considered to be a threat to Canada's war efforts against their homelands. Oh yes, this forced roundup will be challenged in court, and most likely found to violate the rights of those arrested. But by then the Olympic circus will be over. Apologies will be offered, giving cold comfort to those incarcerated. Certainly our Charter of Rights and Freedoms should be no impediment to our protecting visitors from viewing the reality of Vancouver's destitution. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. As we work our way toward the 200th Canadian death in Afghanistan, we can detect a pattern in the news reports of these casualties. First, we hear of the tragic demise of Soldier Blank, accompanied by a quote from his or her commanding officer and mates describing how Blank was well-loved by comrades, a soldier with a great sense of humor, who was always there to help others, blah, blah, blah. Then we get the ramp ceremony with pomp and circumstance as the body is loaded on the plane for home. Soon we hear statements from family telling us that the deceased believed in the mission and died for freedom, justice, and the right of little Afghan girls to go to school. Well, the pattern's been broken. Private Jonathan Cordier was casualty number 131 killed by a mine. His brother told the press, that war over there, he found it a bit useless, that they were wasting their time over there. His sister-in-law echoed this opinion. Other family members said Private Cordier did not want to go to Afghanistan, but he felt it was his job and he had no choice. Last year, the father of a Canadian captain allegedly killed in a freak accident also demurred from praising war when he said, war is stupid. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows that. Well, no, they don't. The politicians don't know that. When the NATO occupation finally collapses and Afghanistan resumes its place as a medieval island of ignorance, superstition, and brutal warlords, there will be plenty of blame to share all around. One thing for sure, Western soldiers will remain in their isolated besieged fortresses to protect the oil wells and gas pipelines. What a criminal shame that we have joined this mission, blowing billions in funds and over 100 soldiers' lives to protect the West's access to fossil fuels. I should have created a file of broken election promises from both the federal conservatives and provincial liberal governments, but where would I store the bulk? Here is my latest contribution to that file. Gordon Campbell pronounced, amid great ceremony, that this year half of BC's kindergarten-age children would attend full-day school. Here we are into the new school year, and still all of these kids are in class for only half-day sessions. That promise, along with other forgotten ones, has been shelved. Of course, the Liberals declare that full-day kindergarten is not dead. It's just been postponed until next year. Opposition members of the legislature say they believe it when they will see it. I would not be surprised to see this proposal disappear until the next provincial election, when it can be resurrected to again harness the votes of hopeful parents of preschoolers. Just another exercise in recycling. As more is revealed of the proposed electric transmission line up Highway 37 North, it becomes clearer the real objectives of this billion-dollar project. The Campbell-Harper Axis claims that this is a green initiative which will replace diesel-generated power in remote communities with hydroelectricity. To coin a phrase, bullshit. The line, as proposed, would run past Mesiaden Junction and Bell 2 to Bob Quinn Lake. Mesiaden Junction's name pretty well describes it. Bell 2 is an isolated seasonal lodge, and when I went through Bob Quinn Lake, I sneezed and missed it. If I make a generous estimate of the combined population to be served with this line, I would guess 100 souls. Do those folk burn enough diesel fuel to be worth $10 million a head to deliver them hydropower? If fuel saving were a real concern, bean counters would balance the diesel to be burned in clearing land, producing the materials for the line, and running all that machinery against future savings in these communities. A real concern might have seen plans for a longer line reaching to Dease Lake, a community which does burn a significant amount of fossil fuel to generate electricity. Buried in the public relations fluff is the fact that there are a number of mining proposals for this stretch of territory, as well as opportunities for independent power projects tapping our rivers for private profit. Should our government borrow large amounts of money to subsidize activities which will increase pollution, including greenhouse gases, while damaging wild fish runs? Another item seldom mentioned is the desire of Alaska to connect with the American electricity grid so they can sell their ample hydropower south. this British Columbia line, if ever built, could become a link for that power. If this is so important to Alaska, why aren't we asking them to build a line so we can tap their power on the way through? The whole project stinks from one end to the other. We have an addition to the profile of suspected types that airport paranoids have to screen for. That's those persons attempting to board aircraft wearing clerical collars. In Cancun, a Bolivian priest hijacked a Mexican plane, explaining later that he was acting on divine instructions. After surrendering to authorities, he explained that God had ordered him to take the plane after a revelation that Mexico was threatened by an earthquake. He failed to explain how his hijacking airplane was to ameliorate the impending disaster. Every year, the Little League World Series of Baseball is held in the town where I was born, Williamsport, Pennsylvania. I haven't heard news of these events since officials declared that, in spite of the name World Series, they decided to exclude teams from Taiwan as they developed a tendency to beat the good old American teams. This year, the contest made the news again, but not for the baseball, but for the advertising on ESPN coverage of the games. It was an ad for hunting rifles, showing kiddies in camouflage playing with guns as big game cavorted in their sights. The implication was clear. These animals were to be downed for the entertainment of the little ones. No shots were fired in the ad. None were necessary. And we wonder why Americans are nutty over firearms. In the interest of promoting Campbell's goal of making British Columbia the best-educated, most literate province in Canada, his government has made drastic cuts to public school funding. I don't understand how this squares, but then I'm not a member of the brain trust that comes up with these policies. Due to precipitous cuts in private funds, promised funds, the Prince George School District suddenly finds itself $5 million in the hole for this academic year. This is most likely more than can be covered by parental bake sales, so I have a few humble suggestions as to how the $5 million could be found. Premier Campbell is paid $188,000 a year. I suppose he earns that. But I learned that BC Hydro alone has 137 employees who take home more than that. The president of BC Ferries made $1 million last year. I suggest that it be a rule that no public employee could be paid more than the premier, and of course that Campbell's wage be frozen. That alone could probably save $5 million and without impoverishing those affected. In fact, it might weed out some of those who are into public service only for the money, leaving the field to those with dedication to the job. If that initiative failed, I suggest a tax of $0.25 or so on all throwaway food and beverage containers dispensed by fast food joints. Customers could avoid this tax by bringing their own coffee cups or eating inside on real dishes. I would tack another $0.50 or so on everyone using drive-through windows. This would be billed as an environmental levy to make up for the pollution of their idling engines. A portion of both these fees could go toward hiring unemployed to clean up roadside litter, most of which is labeled McDonald's, Wendy's, or the ubiquitous Tim Hortons. Do I risk lynching for suggesting such burdensome taxes on consumers? Go get a rope. In 1936, the Olympic Games were hosted by Hitler's Germany. Old Adolf is the man who came up with the torch run gimmick. He had athletes trot a torch, a real torch, through European nations, which, incidentally, his armies later overran. Fast forward 74 years and across the seas to Vancouver. Vanuk plans to carry on Hitler's tradition by schlepping not one but several so-called torches all over Canada. Hitler won't recognize these devices as tortures. They are more Star Wars than World War in design, and butt ugly to boot. Canada's Green Olympics will have a torch trot that is anything but environmentally friendly. The total distance traveled will be 45,000 kilometers, and this will not be sweated out by jogging volunteers. A fleet of vehicles will carry torches from town to village to city, where chosen individuals will run in 300-meter relays through the community, where it will again be picked up and hauled to the next stop. And this won't just be a van doing the transporting. For 106 days, a fleet of gas guzzlers will contain support crew, runners, sponsors, government staff, whatever that may constitute, and security personnel from pillar to post. In many communities, there will be celebrations paid for by a generous provincial government, the same government which cannot pay for public schools. What a stupid waste of scarce public funds. I don't have to tell students this has been a tough summer for finding decent jobs. The days when one could walk easily into work, into a lucrative job, are gone. Even professionally qualified heads of families have had to take McJobs to pay the mortgage, leaving students in the lurch. At one time, I was able to land that great job at Ford, where I sweated for less than $2 an hour. Or, at the time, 10 years later, when I found a better summer job in a steel mill at a fantastic 2.5 plus shift differential. We're into recovery mode, I hear, and the recession is over. That's the good news. The bad news is that layoffs continue and unemployment is still rising. Employers are reluctant to rehire as they are managing to force increasing production from reduced staff. This is the glorious feat called increasing productivity, and it is declared good. A jobless recovery is great for employers. They sweat current staff and are flooded with fat resumes from those seeking any job that opens. Workers can be bullied and cheated as they have no recourse since most, having followed the herd into deep debt, can't afford to quit. This is Tory heaven. Business will revive and workers cowed. In their globalized world, they don't need to have a workforce with the means to buy their products. They can sell them overseas. Henry Ford's idea of paying everyone a magnificent $5 a day so they could buy his cars has fallen victim to globalization. Of course, there's a fallacy at work here. If all nations follow the same pattern of beating down workers, no one but the rich will be able to afford imports and the whole system falls apart. For decades, we could rely on the American public to leverage the inflated value of real estate into debt to fuel their spending, soaking up surplus production worldwide. Those days are over, and we now have a new reality where no one is buying the surplus. Economists tell us that we face a W-shaped or double-dip recession, where the recovery inspired by massive government spending peters out and the economy again collapses as workers can't sustain the growth. They've smartened up. Either they haven't the money due to job loss or they're paying down that massive debt. No matter, we're in for a rough ride. Ralph Nader has a novel out called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, in which a group of billionaires conspires to save the world economy. Lots of luck, it's fiction. I agree that the rich can save us, but it's unlikely that they will do so voluntarily. It can be done by that bugaboo of the Tories, taxation. I said before that I saw a 1949 U.S. tax schedule in which the maximum income tax for one earning over $250,000 was 92%. Since then, various right-wing ideologues have whittled that down to the point where Warren Buffett, the world's richest man, pays a lesser percentage of his annual earnings in tax than do his secretaries. A fairer, more egalitarian world could come about if we trimmed some of the tops from the mountains and used them to fill in the valleys. This concludes the outrageous 328th edition of CFUR's Porcupine Petting Zoo at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Adios, pilgrims.